And we're back. Welcome to Deep Thinking, the motorcycle road racing podcast.
This dog wants cheese.
That's Churchill, and that's Little Man, and this is Ivy, the cat who runs all things.
He's Michael Gugis.
You can read my rantings at motorbikeroadracing.blogspot.com. Occasionally, I don't get there as much as I like to. He's Ed Sorbo.
You can find me at le-suspension.com. You can check out, that's where all the deep thinkings are, on the podcast button. And you can check out my blog, which some of which has quite useful suspension guru information.
Wow. Yeah. Some of it has my rantings.
Some of it has links to Michael's.
And some there's even pictures of me.
There are pictures of Michael, too.
That makes me very happy. Yes. That makes me very, very happy, Ed. Hey, Ed and I were just talking about whether
52.
Or not, yeah, this is episode 52. It's a full year of doing it. Congratulations. Fist bump, mofo. You know
52
what?
52 weeks in a year. You're right.
Absolutely.
Well, it's not actually because when this shows, then it'll be right. I don't feel like it's been a year because we're still a few weeks away.
It's still not exactly a year.
This is the third of three shows made in one batch around the kitchen table at Michael's house.
Right.
With the animals.
And
there's a pizza over there.
Yeah, but
the oven is preheating.
Yeah, it hasn't gone bing yet.
Okay.
Why was I going to say that? Ed, looking back at a full year of Deep Thinking, the motorcycle road racing podcast, what do you think is our greatest accomplishment?
Getting started. Yeah, well, like anything else, getting started is the first thing, right? A journey of 1,000 miles begins with but a single step.
A single cliche.
Right? I mean, seriously,
yeah.
How was it that it came about that I have the life I have now?
Right.
I decided one day, okay, I'm going to move to the mainland. I'm going to live in my motorhome. I'm going to race motorcycles.
Right.
I had no more skills or resources that day than the day before. But if you'd asked me the day before Bill Wickersham said to me, you should, blah, 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 right? I would have said, I can't do it. And the next day, I magically could. So that's why I say, whatever the best thing is of anything successful that you did, the most important one was starting.
Yep, absolutely. We think we mentioned this before, the new R1, 92% of them will never see a racetrack.
Yeah, they don't need to. They're a great bike in the parking lot.
Yeah, granted, but still, that's people who could
Tommy Heller, remember I told you he's painted his already?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he painted it, and then the color didn't come out on the wheels, so he repainted the wheels, and then he, I forget, but it's a multiple part process, but the bike looks good.
The cool
thing for Tommy is, right, yeah, that shade of pink didn't work out. Well, we'll just paint it this other shade tonight.
who's Tommy?
The guy in Hawaii that has the auto repair place that does all the stuff that's painting
his
R1. Try to keep up. Tommy Heller.
I can't possibly keep up with Ed. You're so popular.
You know, there's a neat Tommy Heller story. So back in the day when Team Hawaii was doing pretty well, we were coming to races pretty regularly.
Okay.
Tommy was one of the guys, you know, that came to Sport Bike Hawaii and he was a regular customer and he was a helper with the club. You know, everybody there did something together. There wasn't that many of us. Anyway, we needed more riders for Team Hawaii 2, whatever year this was. And we felt that Tommy would be pretty good, but we wanted to make sure that he would perform under pressure.
Okay.
Right? And so, you know, if you're only ever raced in your little club in Hawaii, and now there's a chance to go to the mainland for a professional national race, it's a big deal.
Right.
So we said, okay, Tommy, go ride my bike. I think it was my R6. It was one of my Hurricanes, and we're going to be timing you, we're going to be watching you. We'd really already decided we were going to take him, but we wanted to see how he did under pressure. So go ride, and you're being tested. So it was like a tryout, you know?
Right.
And he did perfect, right? He ran good, consistent lap times. He didn't make any mistakes. He didn't crash my bike. And he comes back in the pits, and we go, okay, you're on the team. Now, understand that on the team means you got to save up your money, and you got to pitch in your part, right? It wasn't a paid gig or anything.
You're on the team. Give us a check.
Exactly. Well, actually, the way we did it is I had a savings account, and each year we figured out an amount, and I think the average amount was $300 that you had to chip in towards the team, plus you had to buy your own airfare and whatever, right? And so I made a savings account so people could make payments throughout the year. You know, they didn't have to wait. And then also there would be money in the account so we could start buying things early on. And at the end of the season, race is over, account was zero, and we start again next year. It worked really well.
That's very clever. Bruce Lind, the Flying Circus.
Yes.
You know, that whole thing about how we had the cost per mile.
Well, yeah. So what Bruce did was he figured out the cost per mile. He broke it down.
Right.
And it was this many miles from this track to the next. So the gas fee was going to be X, right, divided by however many bikes were in the trailer for that event, that leg.
Yep.
And that was how that they did that.
Right.
Yep.
You
know, there was another Weira Endurance team that had a Wednesday night special.
Which was?
That was, they all got together at the shop on Wednesday nights and worked, right, on the bike for a few hours, and they did this over the course of many months. And then that was their race bike.
And the bike is spectacular, and you don't have to spend a lot of money.
You get to hang out with your buddies
time
and do stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure there's pizza involved.
Yep.
You know, very cool. The Ed, why don't you ask me what the greatest accomplishment of motorbike road racing?
Michael, what do you think the greatest accomplishment of thinking deeply is so far?
Deep thinking, the motorcycle road racing podcast. Two words, Ed. Hickory Farms. Right. We got free meat, dude. Free meat. Okay.
And cheese.
Yep. But you know, anybody can get cheese. When you get free meat, you're onto something. All
okay.
Right?
What do we got on our list?
What do we got on the list? And I bought a book. Oh,
yeah.
There's a pizza.
There's the pizza's ready.
Yes.
Oh no. Time to put the pizza in the pizza cooker.
Right. Pizza cookers.
That's people call them ovens. We call them pizza cookers.
Just a pizza cooker.
Yeah. Aren't you supposed to put it on a surface of some kind?
It's on a surface. Okay. You know, thank God they have these things that they call self-cleaning ovens. Hold on, let me let little man back.
The dogs and cats are going in and out in groups.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. I bought a book, Ed.
Okay, what
I'm very,
what book
very
did
proud
you
of
buy?
Myself. It's called Honda GP Racers by Colin McKellar.
Cool.
Yeah, and it's a it traces Honda's re-entry into MotoGP racing up to about 1997, the 500 bikes, and then as the chapter I'm reading now, the rest of the family, the 125s and the 250s. Okay, kind of a bunch of really cool stuff. Freddie Spencer's 250-500 championship season. Nobody else had a 250 like him.
Freddie's 250 was the first factory 250 GP bike.
It was they had made a production one, then they made a really fast version of the production one, and then they made one for Freddie, and it was basically half of their 500.
That was the first time the factory. So he had a substantial power advantage on the rest of the field.
The bike
to say that it was easy for him to win two championships in the same year,
right,
but in the 250 class, he pretty much had it wrapped up.
The bike was amazing.
Well, he was able to stop. He wrapped up the championship that year three or four races before the season was over.
He showed up at Daytona with that 250. It smoked the field and just said, I can do this. I can win both titles. You know, the bike was that good. But the reason that I was thinking about you while I was reading this book, you're not a big Honda guy, it's been, we've been talking about, all season long, we've been talking about why the Yamaha M1 is such a good motorcycle. And part of it is because, you and I have talked about this, they have thought about how to have the best possible bike when the lights go out. And that means not just designing a world-class bike on the drawing board, but building a bike that can be tuned and engineered at the track within the very tight time constraints of practice and qualifying and all of that. And you know, allow you to not, you never have to go, I wish we could do this to the bike, but we can't. We don't have time. And that was, that's why I was thinking about this. If you go back through the history of Honda's GP racers, they never thought about that some seasons.
Well,
not even close.
To be fair,
right?
We're talking about a time long enough ago that there were limitations to the engineering that they could do. You know, they couldn't build cases to the spec that they wanted to build cases. They had to do this other thing and had to put more bolts in it and stuff like that.
Right.
I would say the best example of paying attention to the working on the motorcycle when you're building the bike would be a TZ250. Bruce Lind and I changed the crankshaft on my bike in an hour and a half.
Oh, I saw you do it in John's bike in about that amount of time.
Yeah, you did see us change it. But
that was amazing.
That was way more than an hour and a half. But I'm talking Bruce Lind and I, from the time we start working to the time the bike's running in the pits, an hour and a half.
Wow.
That's really impressive.
Yeah.
But they didn't. But that's because it was designed with that in mind, right? That you can take the front half of the cases off with the rest of the engine still in the bike, you know, that kind of thing. So some of those bikes back in the day, like I've never worked on one, but I would imagine that replacing the valves on a 250 six cylinder was just a nightmare, right? You know?
Oh, my God.
But right? I think it's always been an engineering goal to make it, look, we got to change the needles on these carburetors every weekend. Let's make it so we can get to the damn carburetor.
So let's talk about carburetors, okay? The NR500, that was when Honda came back in with the four-stroke 500 with the oval pistons.
Also known as the No Reason 500. according to Mike Kaufman.
Okay. Actually, no, I'm sorry. We need to go forward a little further that in history. 1984 NSR 500. That was the one where they said...
That was like evil.
Yeah, because it had the gas tank underneath the motor, right. The pipes on the top, right? This has got to work.
No.
This is from Jeremy Burgess was interviewed in the book, and this was spectacular. Okay, you can't get to the carbs, okay, without removing the pipes.
And burn your hands.
Right, you can't touch the pipes when they're crazy hot, right? So...
Fortunately, two-stroke pipes don't get as hot as four-stroke pipes.
Really? How come?
They lower RPM, lower temperature. It's a big space, so the air is going much slower.
Much bigger space.
Yeah, the two-stroke pipe is using the pressure waves.
Right.
The four-stroke pipe is all about flow.
That's true.
And it just doesn't get nearly as hot. So, like, if you have even just a pair of cotton gloves on, you could grab those pipes and pull them and set them on the ground. Right after the bike comes in. It's not like a four-stroke pipe where you have skin left on there.
Right.
But I want to hear what Jerry said about that. Okay. This is an insane idea.
You couldn't get to the carburetors underneath the pipes, okay? Right. So this is their solution. And this is one of those solutions when somebody proposes it to you, you go, not only are we not doing that, but we need to go back and redesign whatever caused you to come up with that idea. They came up with... You know how the rear axle adjuster is on an eccentric on some things? They had an eccentric main jet on the carbs.
You could just dial the main
but you couldn't see it. The carburetor engineer said you had to reach under there, remember where it was last time you had it, and then kind of feel the number of clicks.
Do you know why Honda put the gas tank underneath and the carbs the pipes on the top?
It was a center of gravity thing rather than a center of mass thing.
They thought that by lowering the weight, the bike would change direction quicker.
Yeah, turns out not so much.
It's mind-blowing that they got that wrong. Mm. That means they think that the bike pivots on the tire contact patch.
Yeah.
Everybody knows the bike pivots on the center of mass.
Now we know.
I knew that back then.
Well, why didn't they call you, Ed?
Yeah, I didn't have my cell. Well, I didn't have a cell phone for them to call, I guess. But
that's the only reason.
I don't know why.
It was somebody at HRC going, if Sorbo only had a cell phone.
All you have to do is watch a bike coming towards you, weaving through cones.
Right.
And you can see it pivoting on the center of mass, just like a slalom skier.
They pissed away half.
Well, they also made carbon fiber wheels when carbon fiber manufacturing processes weren't ready for it and had a wheel break and crash ready.
But don't you just love that idea of the eccentric main jet?
You know the GS550ES?
Yes.
So it had the twin carburetor bodies and an oval thing.
Right.
Okay. So I went to a dealer show and they had a Mikuni wreck there. Uh-huh. And I had that bike at the time and I asked him about
that. You had one?
It was great. It handled great.
I had one.
I hated that thing for the carburetors, but beautiful bike otherwise. First brand new bike I ever bought.
Me too.
Wow.
No shit.
Yeah, that must be how we got together.
Oh, that must be. Did you crash yours?
No.
Ah, oh, man. I lobbed that thing down Mulholland Highway.
I raced mine.
Wow.
Anyway, I went to the booth and I'm like talking to the guy and getting his card and whatever. And I said, oh, by the way, you know, I have the GS550. And he goes, I'm sorry about those carburetors. They're Mikuni carburetors, right?
Right. It's on behalf of the company, I apologize sincerely.
Funny as hell.
Never got
that thing jetted right.
That was just spectacular, though. It's just one of those things where, it's the boiling water thing, right? We just need to fix one more little thing. Okay, now we just need to fix one more little thing. And now Jerry Burgess is blindfolded, reaching under there, trying to feel clicks.
I'm surprised he stayed with Honda after that. Maybe after that, they're like, maybe we should listen to that Jerry guy
maybe
in Australia.
Because exactly,
he
right?
turned out to be right about all of this stuff.
And book is filled with great examples like that. Apparently, Mike Elwood, the first time he tested one of their bikes, he asked their engineers to remove the rear shocks. You've heard this story.
I talked to the director of Suzuka Land, and I asked him if that story, personally, at the track, is that story true? And he said, yes, they are still in that pond right there.
Yes, yes. For those of you who don't know the story, Mike asked the engineers to pull the rear shocks off the bike. The engineers did.
Twin shocks back in the day.
Twin shocks. They handed him the shocks. He said, thank you very much. He walked over to a lake and he threw the shocks into the lake.
It's not really a lake. It's a pond in the infield at Suzuka Circuit. And he chucked them out there so that they would be forced to put new shocks on some other brand that had some stupid.
Okay, so speaking of this was fun to read this book just because it's a series of disasters. They pissed away half a season because the swing arm pivot point was in the wrong place and the bike was, you know,
that's the kind of thing that you have to figure out through testing.
Right?
I don't think you can. I mean, maybe now with all the knowledge, you can know where it's going to happen if you do it here and there, and you know where to put it. But at some point back then, those guys had to figure that shit out.
Exactly.
So I'm not going to beat anybody up about that one. The upside down gas tank thing, that was just stupid. Let's imagine that it is better to have the gas tank down lower.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Let's say a little bit of performance bit.
I guarantee you that melting your rider's balls is going to make the bike slower than any possible center of mass change that you can make. Right? Am I not right?
Right.
I mean, folks, let's think about it. Let's turn on our ovens.
Right.
And let's tuck in over our oven.
Right.
And see how long we can stay there.
Start humping the burner.
Yeah. I mean, come on. The beauty of that is, right, here's the thing to take away from this.
Right.
It doesn't matter how much education you got, how big your team is, how smart your group is, everybody gets it wrong.
Yeah. Everybody, right? Occasionally.
The thing is to do what Honda did and what NASA does and what all other successful engineering firms do.
Let's go.
Is they go, oh yeah, that didn't work.
Yep.
Okay, we learned X, Y, and Z from that. And now we're going to move forward and guarantee you Honda will never put the gas tank underneath again, right?
You know what?
If they do, they'll have fuel injection and they won't need the little thingy for the main jet.
Yeah, I guarantee you that. No, it's actually funny. What it talks about was, we're going to get to the NR500 in just a second here, but the officials were actually a little nervous about going to their engineers and going, yeah, you know, we really need to stop this four-stroke nonsense. We need to go to a two-stroke. They were afraid they were going to hurt
the
people's feelings.
Well, the myth is that Mr. Honda from back in the day wanted four-strokes.
Well, it related to what they were selling, and they knew that emissions were coming, and they knew the day as a two-stroke on a street bike was numbered. But the Honda higher-ups were afraid to go to their engineering department and say, all that hard work you put in on the four-stroke, we're really going to have to change to two-strokes. Turns out when they finally did, they were greeted
like,
with,
thank God.
Thank you. Thank you. Please, can we kindly build a goddamn race-winning bike? Here, but I just wanted to share this one with you, Ed. This is this was just one of those management decisions that seems halfway kind of logical at the time you do it, and you look back later and go, "Oh my God, what were you doing?" So they're building the Honda NR500 engine. For those of you who don't remember this, it was an oval piston thing.
They were trying to get the same results of a V8,
right.
But the rules didn't allow a V8. So they made the pistol oval-shaped so you could have 8 valves per piston, per cylinder, instead of only 4.
Right.
That
was
part of
the
it
idea.
Worked fine. 2 rods for per piston. And the real genius there is how they successfully made the rings seal.
Yes.
We still don't know that. That's a trade secret.
A lot of hard work.
A lot of metallurgy, basic engineering went into
really
that thing.
Really good learning.
And that's a perfect example of back to our first episode.
Racing.
Why race?
Yeah,
and
why
that's,
race?
That's the reason.
Exactly. So you let those guys do it, okay? So, engine guys, clean sheet, blue sky, first principles thinking, right? The chassis guy comes in and says, if they get to do some clear sky thinking, so do I. And the overall project manager is actually quoted in the book as saying, how could I say no to him when the engine guys are doing it? And that's the last thing in the world you do. You minimize the variables.
Yeah, that's a problem that all of these people that try to make their own bikes get trapped by.
Yes.
Too many new concepts.
Too many new
concepts.
And
then when you have a problem, you can't tell which one or what combination is causing the problem.
Exactly. And that was it. That was where the first NR...
But the picture that I saw of the first NSR...
NR.
Had a regular old school steel tube conventional
chassis. No, that's the first two-stroke that they finally came back with. It actually had a tubular frame chassis.
I've seen a picture of a four-stroke oval piston bike, and it had a conventional tubular frame
That may have been later. The first one...
Because this was in like the early 80s.
Yeah.
The first box steel tube box frame was the 83 Interceptor.
Well, the first NR500 was 79.
Right.
And it had the monocoque. What we would look at...
I don't remember that.
What we would look at nowadays is a fairing lower, one that comes up fairly high. That was the chassis. It was 1 millimeter of twin wall aluminum. Okay, and it basically, that was, you bolted the engine into that, okay? That thin wall...
I'm going to have to take this book home with me.
I don't think that's going to be happening, dude. It's a great book. I'll let you read it as soon as I'm done with it. But
read faster.
Yeah, the headstock was actually, what we would see as the fairing lower, the headstock was attached to that.
I'll try to get a picture of this and post it up when this episode comes out. Hopefully this will be the picture that goes with the episode.
They called it the shrimp shell.
Which, by the way, I have a really fun time always picking a picture that Michael could never... He's like, I didn't think of that. I wouldn't have picked that picture.
Exactly. Yeah, wow, roasted balls.
Speaking of great pictures.
Okay, go
so
on.
So motorcycle.com just did a top 10 list.
Okay.
So one of their regular features is they do top 10 whatever.
Okay.
So they did top 10 suspension misconceptions.
Okay.
With Ed Sorbo.
Got it.
And so the last one, I titled The Earth is Flat.
Okay.
Okay, because it's the biggest misconception people had. And they found a picture of a map of a flat Earth. It was really cool.
Absolute genius.
Check that out. Motorcycle.com on their top 10 tab.
What's holding up the Earth in that picture? Or is it just a map of the Earth?
It's just a map of the Earth. They don't show the whole solar system.
They don't show
system,
the Atlas standing on top of the turtle.
No,
and
they don't that.
The
it's
elephants.
Turtles all the way
turtles
down.
Turtles all the way down. Exactly. Go ask your mother. The reason that I brought up the NR500, and this is the, like I said, and this is the bad management decision, is what they wound up with. You wound up with the bike. To change the jetting, you had to take the bike apart. And literally, the whole engine... rear wheel swing arm assembly had to be detached via a whole bunch of bolts from the monocoque. There's a great series of pictures in this book where you've got two different frame brace kind of things. It's like pulling apart
like
a locomotive.
Yeah,
it was hysterical. And you're just looking at that thing going, if it was nearly perfect when it left the factory, they still couldn't tune it at the track to make it into something that would work.
Well, the one of the solutions to that problem, which I'm sure they're doing now, right, is they have guys like Jerry Burgess at the factory, right? That's what Honda does, right? They have their new engineers engineer stuff, so
right.
They learn this shit.
Right.
I mean, it's a bummer that they get third and fourth in the championship this year.
Yes.
But that's a lot less of a bummer than they build a bike that they have to recall all of them.
Right.
And people get hurt.
Right.
And they lose, right? That's real money.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, that's what racing is for, and you learn these lessons. And then on the flip side,
right,
the guy who engineered the 250 six-cylinder,
right,
led the CBX.
Yep.
Arguably the greatest bike of all time to this day. Like, let me ask you a question.
Just the sheer coolness factor.
What do you want? An R1, M, or a CBX?
At my age, yeah. CBX.
There you go.
No question.
Right?
I can't.
If you're riding your R1 down the street,
right,
your friend goes, wow, that's a nice bike.
Right.
Good choice. And when you ride a CBX down the street, women run out of the woods.
Taking their clothing off.
Exactly.
As they,
right? Men say, I want to be him.
Right.
Women say, I want to be
with him.
I mean,
exactly.
CBX is the bike.
Oh, my God. That some of the custom exhaust systems. I saw
The sound of that
art.
Bike.
Just art. Yep. Oh, my God. Those were spectacular. Ed, I think it's time. We can keep going if you want, but what else are you going to say?
I don't know. I can't tell your chicken scratch if we're
at
the bottom of your list or not.
I just love that. That was just such a horrible management decision. You know, he gets to play with the new technology. I want to too.
What does that say?
Oh, we got a living room full of stuff that got shipped from Sandy's mom's house after Sandy's mom died. The guy in the Beacon, the guy who drove the Beacon's truck. This no lie, just happened just like a week or two ago.
The moving truck.
Moving
Beacons,
truck.
Okay.
Beacons, right? Shows up. My garage is open because they're going to move some stuff in there too. He looks at the bikes. He looks at the trophies and says, you got some cool toys, huh? I said, yeah. I like to ride. I like to race. He pulls up his pants leg and he's got fucking R6 tattooed onto his calf. He says, this was my last race bike before I had my first kid. And it turns out he raced AMA and CCS over on the East Coast, you know, and then when he had a kid, you know, wasn't going to do that anymore.
You got all smart, huh?
Yeah. Oh, all smart, right? But anyway, I just thought, oh dear. I thought we were supposed to have a timer going for this, sweetie.
It's the new Cajun blackened pizza.
It's Cajun blackened pizza.
It's only too hot around the edges.
Okay,
so I'm going to do the 2-minute morning while Michael is rescuing the pizza.
Yeah, there's no rescuing this one.
So I apologize for not remembering your name, but a very nice young lady asked me question at a recent track day that I was at, and she was concerned because she wants to move up in the next group, but she wasn't sure if she's qualified to move up. And first of all, if you're asking that question, you're probably more qualified than most people. Don't forget to turn that oven off.
Because
most people are like, hey, it's my first day at the track. I'm going to be in the fast group, right? Which you probably are not qualified for. So my point is, if you're thinking this way, then you're thinking, and that means we like you. You're probably doing stuff right.
You know, Ed and I were just talking.
And to fine-tune this a little bit more, her real concern was that she would be in the way of other people.
Right.
So I told her what I tell everybody when they're thinking about that. The best thing that I can see on a racetrack as I come up on somebody is them on my line exactly.
Exactly.
Because if they're on a good line, I know they're probably pretty smart. And the closer that you get to the correct line, the more predictable you become.
Right, the less
variation.
It's
easy for me to come up on you on my line, use your draft, move over a little while, go by you in a predictable way, and continue on my way. When you're over there somewhere, and then I'm like, and you're going slow, then I'm like, oh, where's he going to go next? Because at that speed, he can go any fucking place he wants.
Exactly.
They're unpredictable and they're scary.
When they're on the racing line, I try not to pass like right at the apex of a corner unless I'm around the outside and they're there. But on a track day, if I'm passing somebody as they're coming out of a corner, I know what line they're going to use. All I need to do is move inside or outside of them a couple of feet, and we're all good.
Exactly.
Because I know exactly where they're going to be.
What's the number one rule of track activities? The overtaking rider is responsible for making the safe pass.
Right.
Okay? So if you are in front of me and you're predictable, then it's easy for me to make a safe pass.
Easy and safe.
Okay?
Oh,
so
boy.
You worrying about being in my way is the last of your concerns.
Right.
You thinking about your skill sets, what you're going to do, where you're going to go, when you're going to do it, all of that stuff. You're busy doing that. That is perfect.
Right.
Hey, if the closing speed is 100 miles an hour, we probably need to be in different groups just because the closing speed is 100 miles an hour. But my point is, even if it's 100 miles an hour, if you're predictable, I see you. I have an instant judgment of when and where I'm going to catch you. I make my changes and I go by, and it's, and then I don't even remember you were there.
Exactly. You know, I'm at probably the track I've ridden at more than anything is Willow Springs, okay? Turn 8. On a track day, if we're going into turn 8 and I see you on the inside line through there, I'm probably okay. Because I know that if you're slower than me, that you're not going to swing all the way to the outside immediately most of the time. The thing that scares me most is that the rider who's on the outside of the track, and they're going slow.
Yeah, then they can turn in
at any point,
imaginary apex. I'm supposed to be there now.
Exactly. You know? That's scarier than hell.
You know, everybody knows that Michael Barnes is pretty much as tough as they get.
Right.
Remember, this is the guy who slid into the wall at Pikes Peak on his ass, broke his ankle when he was deflected like a billiard ball by the wall back down towards the track. And while he's still going about 50, 60 miles an hour on his ass, he's given the signal, the corner worker signal for the ambulance, because he knows his ankle is broken.
Right.
I've seen that guy scared to shaking because of a slow rider on a fast bike making unpredictable apex lunges in turn 2 at Brainerd.
Turn 2. Oh, geez.
Really fast
corner,
right?
Oh, my God. Right.
So if that person had been spending that person's time thinking about their line in advance, they would not have been way on the outside going, oh shit, my apex is way over there, I'll just go there now.
Yeah.
Right? So the rider's, your job as a rider is to do the best you can all the time. That makes you predictable. Don't worry about the guys passing you. You think you're ready to move up to a group, go to the people in charge at whatever
and ask them
and say, hey, please let me, I'd like to go up. at a at the worst case, they're going to say, okay, we're going to have one of our instructors follow you around and pass judgment and yes or no. But move up as soon as you can and spend as little time as possible in group two. In group one, the slowest group, and not everybody uses the same numbering system, but in the slowest group, you have all the new people, and they generally are new people who aren't sure what to do, and they're being careful and trying to remember all the guidelines and the rules, and you don't have very many problems.
Right.
In group three, generally people have a fair amount of skill set, they have a decent plan, they're reasonably quick, and you'll notice the faster people get, the closer and closer their lines become.
Yes.
Because there's only really one really good line.
There's only really one line.
In group two is where you have all the sophomores, the smart fools. The people think they know every... I've been to three track days. I'm ready for group two. This is where you hear the comments, I won group two. By guys that really think you can win group two. You don't want to be around those idiots.
I won group two.
None of those guys listen to deep thinking. Move directly from slow to fast as quickly as you can.
Exactly.
And if somebody gives you shit about it, say, listen, Ed Sarbo said he doesn't mind passing me as long as I'm predictable.
Exactly. There's only one line.
He's Michael Gugis.
He's Ed Sarbo.
Aloha.